I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee released its fifth and final report, almost 1,000 pages, on Russian interference in the 2016 election. What makes the report notable is that it is bipartisan, and it goes into greater detail than the Mueller report did about contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia. It also reveals how the Kremlin exploited the inexperience and vulnerabilities of members of the Trump team for its own purposes. Take Paul Manafort, former campaign chair. The committee concluded that he willingly shared campaign data and strategies with Russian intelligence services, representing a, quote, grave counterintelligence threat. Mark Mazzetti has read the report, and he joins us by Skype to tell us more and why it matters. He's Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times. And, Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
This kind of got buried last week between the Democratic National Convention, the U.S. Postal Service controversies. Also, after Senate intelligence reports, and after the Mueller investigation, what do you think is the most significant conclusion of this particular report?
No, you're right. I mean, this kind of came and went, and it was not something, I will be honest, you know, that I was expecting a great deal from. You know, as you said, there have been other volumes of the Senate investigation, and we didn't know really what to expect from this final report. But it truly exceeded expectations in my mind, because what it did was it put the Russian operation much more in the context of a national security threat. And how the Russian intelligence services designed to sabotage the 2016 election. If you think back to the Mueller report, and a lot of people were frustrated about how the Mueller report was used very tortured language, a lot of double negatives, wasn't particularly clear. It's because the Mueller investigation was designed to determine whether there was crimes that were committed. It was a legal document. And so it had to be careful in how it was written in terms of what evidence there was that crimes were committed. And ultimately, Mueller, as we know, said there was no criminal conspiracy between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. This investigation is far more unbound by that. They can make assertions. They can use evidence and cite evidence that they're not going to be using in court, but it's to build a case of a Russian intelligence operation. And I think that's what makes it a somewhat fascinating and persuasive document.
And I do want to talk about some of the details in it, but there is a question, and there was some disagreement on the Intelligence Committee about whether was this collusion, was this cooperation, was this coordination, was it a conspiracy, were there contacts, was there, what do we call, I guess, what this relationship was between the Trump campaign and Russia?
That's a great question. And, you know, everyone is going to use their own word to describe it. The Democrats in the appendix they wrote to the report were very clear. They say this shows collusion. I think their line was, you know, if this isn't collusion, then nothing is. Republicans, of course, Marco Rubio, who is the acting head of the committee, the Republican senator from Florida, said we found no collusion. No obstruction of justice. That's the sort of mantra that President Trump has been using for some time. So what is this? It is certainly a deep level of contacts between the Russian government, Russian intelligence service, people affiliated with Russian intelligence, and the Trump campaign. In some cases, the members of the Trump campaign were very eager for the help that the Russians wanted to provide. In some cases, as you brought up Paul Manafort, the Trump campaign chairman, he's actually giving Russians who are identified in this report as members of Russian intelligence internal information about the campaign, strengths and weaknesses, data about where they're putting money, etc. And one could certainly conceive that that is information the Russian government could be using for its own campaign to meddle in the election. Now, what does it not say? It doesn't say that there was a close coordination at the very top level where the members of the Trump campaign and the Kremlin sat down and said, okay, let's win this thing together. For those looking for that,
This report doesn't have that. And so that's why I think there's going to be something for all sides to sort of hang their hat on to say, ah, it proves my case.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Paul Manafort. He was chair of the Trump campaign just really for a couple of months. This was during mostly the summer of 2016 through the convention. He had this relationship with a guy named Konstantin Kalimnik, who the report identifies as a Russian intelligence officer. And that made news. That's new, correct?
That's right. I mean, we've written a lot about Kalimnik, and the Mueller investigation describes Kalimnik as someone affiliated with Russian intelligence. So someone who at least was in this orbit of Russian intelligence. The Senate report is far more declarative. It just says he is a Russian intelligence right. officer. A lot of the supporting material for that assertion is redacted from the report. So we don't, you know how they're really basing that claim. But they, as you say, are quite definitive about his ties to Russian intelligence. And quite interestingly, they even say that they have some evidence that he was somehow involved in perhaps the most notorious Russian effort during the 2016 election, which was the hacking and leaking of Democratic emails. We don't know more than that, you know, that little glimpse, and because so much is redacted, but it's certainly tantalizing. He is a key figure for this report because he's kind of a linchpin between Paul Manafort, who's running the campaign during the critical period during the summer of 2016, and the Russian intelligence effort that is going on at the time, which involved, of course, at the very least, hacking and leaking the Democratic emails, all of the fake news operations, and various other influence campaigns that were going on.
Does the report say that Manafort knew that Konstantin Kalimnik was a Russian intelligence officer? Does it claim that?
No, but it says that that his former deputy, Manafort's former deputy, Gates, who will also be known to people who follow this story closely, said he suspected that he was a Russian intelligence, and that certainly he had a military intelligence background that I think a guy like Manafort would certainly have known. Interestingly, we asked Manafort in 2017, the New York Times did, about our own reporting about contacts with Russian intelligence, and he said, you know, he never knowingly consorted with a Russian intelligence officer, but he said, you know, these people don't wear badges that say I'm with Russian intelligence.
But as this report says, and as you have reported about it, it seemed as if the Kremlin or the GRU or these intelligence services or these individuals saw members of the Trump campaign, if not as an easy mark, at least people who could be manipulated.
That's right. And I think, you know, the way you put it first is not a bad way to think about it. I mean, they were an easy mark, right? This is a group of people who were, you know, not professional politicians. They were business people. They were people who were associates of the president, you know, Mr. Trump, the real estate developer at the time. These are family members. These are longtime friends. These are people who had foreign business ties over the years, and who, you know, were running a campaign for the first time. And so people were coming forward and saying, hey, we can help you. And, you know, for whatever reason, they accepted that help. Now, there could be different reasons. Certainly, it has been postulated, and there's evidence of this, that, you know, everyone was in it for themselves. These are people who didn't necessarily think Donald Trump was going to win the election, but, you know, perhaps we're making contacts for the future. We're making business connections, wanted to see after the election when inevitably Hillary Clinton won, maybe they would have business opportunities down the road. There's a lot of different explanations for it. But as you put it, if you're the Russians and if you are Russian intelligence trying to sort of implement this campaign to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton, people like this are very useful to you.
Let me ask you one more question about Paul Manafort. Now, he did have some financial involvement relationships with some Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs. In fact, owed a lot of money, millions of dollars. Who did he owe the money to?
Well, it's interesting. That's a big part of the report. He had a long time business dealings with a number of oligarchs, both In Ukraine, who pro-Russian oligarchs in Ukraine, in particular a man named Oleg Deripaska. He had done work with Mr. Deripaska in Ukraine for years, but he was in hock to him. He owed him money. And so one of the things the report goes into detail about is how Manafort saw his working with the Trump campaign and his dealings with these senior advisors to Mr. Trump as a way to perhaps ultimately pay off Deripaska. He could give information, and it's a way to get out of debt. Now, the person you mentioned earlier, Konstantin Kilimnik, is a person who is mentioned as the sort of conduit between Manafort and Deripaska. And so there is a number of cases mentioned in the report where Manafort's giving information to Kilimnik, and Manafort's people kind of know that Kilimnik is then going to be giving it to Deripaska. And why does that matter? Well, because the report says very clearly that Deripaska is very close to Putin. He's close to the Kremlin. Presumably anything that goes to Deripaska would ultimately go to more senior members of the Russian government. And that's why these ties are so important to explore, because they show that, you know, whether it's for business reasons, whether it's for ideology, these are what kind of bound people in the Trump world in 2016 to Russia.
I'm careful to use this word, but as you're describing this relationship and the sharing of information, are we talking about someone being a traitor to the United States?
There's certainly no information that that any of these campaign officials, acted traitorously, if that's the right word, or committed treason, I think I should say. That is a obviously that is a legal term.
Sure.
Some might disagree with my assertion, and it came up earlier, interestingly, in court. With Michael Flynn, another of the Trump campaign advisors who became national security advisor, where a judge actually asserted that maybe Mr. Flynn committed treason, but then quickly had to backtrack, say, I didn't mean to say that. So there's no evidence or assertion in this report that any of these people committed treason. The question is, of course, what was it? What to make of all of these all of this consorting during this period of time with a foreign adversarial intelligence service. These people may have not known they were working with Russian spies, but they certainly were offered information which they knew said, in some cases, this comes from the Russian government, and it is to help you and harm your opponent, Hillary Clinton. And they were willing to accept it. They were eager to accept it. And at no time ever did any of these people say, you know what, we should call the FBI because this is wrong.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Mark Mazzetti, he's Washington investigative correspondent for the New York Times, talking about the Senate Intelligence Committee report released last week on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Much more after this very short break, including Roger Stone. We'll be right back. This is Radio Time.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Mark Mazzetti from the New York Times about a new release last week, 1,000-page bipartisan Senate Intelligence Committee report on Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election, concluding that Russia meddled to help elect Donald Trump, that Russia manipulated members of the Trump campaign, and members of the campaign cooperated with Russia. You can join us. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Mark, let's talk about Roger Stone and WikiLeaks. What was the relationship that the report found about the contacts between, I guess, Russian intelligence, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and the Trump campaign, and I guess Roger Stone, will throw him in on that as well.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting things about the report. And for people who want kind of all of this boiled down, you know, there is the old question, what did the president know and when did he know it, right? That's from Watergate. And people will want to know from this report, what did Donald Trump know and when did he know it about the Russian operation? And the real key here is the conversations that Trump had with Roger Stone, his longtime advisor. Now, what we know is that Roger Stone was saying at the time, he seemed to indicate that he knew in advance that WikiLeaks was going to be putting out a lot of damning information about Hillary Clinton. He now says he had no direct contact with WikiLeaks. But what we do know is that he was communicating directly with Guccifer 2.0, which is the online pseudonym for Russian intelligence that was dumping out this information. Now, what the report says is that while Donald Trump said he never spoke to Roger Stone in advance of these WikiLeaks releases, and that he didn't know they were coming, and this is what he told the Mueller investigators, the Senate report says, we don't believe that. We said there is, they said, we think there's evidence that the president and Roger Stone spoke in advance of some of these releases. And so when the president said he had no advance knowledge, he wasn't being truthful with the Mueller investigators. So what does it all mean? It certainly, again, isn't entirely conclusive, but it does indicate that in the person of Roger Stone, who had these relationships with the people leaking the emails, that Stone seemed to indicate, or seemed to tell the president, the candidate Trump, in advance. And, you know, it does raise the question, if the Mueller investigators had in fact decided to subpoena the president rather than just having him answer written questions, you know, might they have gotten to the bottom of that?
In fact, let me quote from the report, Mark, just underscore what you just said there. And the report said, quoting, despite Trump's recollection, the committee assesses that Trump did, in fact, speak with Stone about WikiLeaks and with members of his campaign about Stone's access to WikiLeaks on multiple occasions, but does not go on to say that the president lied, just saying that his recollection was incorrect.
That's right. And so, again, you know, for anyone looking for, you know, clear, definitive answers on this question of the president's role and the president's level of knowledge, you know, they won't find it here. And, you know, this might be the last official, you know, word from a government body about the 2016 election interference. So, you know, maybe it's something that is never known. But it is, I think, It is so much has been written and so much has been produced about this this period of time that I think there are some things that are known. And where I kind of come down on this question of you know, what was Putin thinking and what the Russian government was up to, if I may.
Sure.
You know, there's been this question of, you know, was Donald Trump the Manchurian candidate who had been groomed all along by the Russians and the Kremlin? I don't think there's any evidence of that. However, I think it's quite certain that Vladimir Putin was determined to sabotage the 2016 election. He was determined to hurt the candidacy of Hillary Clinton. And if Hillary Clinton had run against a traditional Republican like, let's say, Jeb Bush, who might have had a more traditional hawkish view on Russia, then he would have probably tried to take down both sides. But if once Donald Trump became the candidate, and once Donald Trump surrounds himself with people like Mike Flynn, Paul Manafort, Carter Page, some of these people who had been sort of dealing with Russia over the years. And once Trump starts saying he wants to have a rapprochement with Russia, then it's kind of game on. Then Putin says, okay, well, I don't have to sort of hurt both sides. I can go all in to help Donald Trump hurt Hillary Clinton. And lo and behold, Donald Trump becomes president. So I think that there's a calculation by the Russians sometime around February or March in 2016, and the documents show this, to really accelerate this campaign on one side once it becomes crystal clear that it's going to be Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton.
Let me ask you about Attorney General Barr. He has his own investigation headed up by a guy named John Durham. And he says he, quote, wants to get to the bottom of the grave abuses involved in the bogus Russiagate scandal. He has his own report, his own investigation going on. Are these two reports on a collision course, do you think?
Well, it's a good point. I think one of the most significant things about this report is that it really undercuts what Barr has been saying for a year. And Barr, including some of Trump's other allies, is that they've been saying, hey, there was no there there. As you said, he said, you know, bogus Russiagate scandal. Right. That he has been trying to sort of flip the script to say the real abuses were by the FBI and the CIA who were investigating the president. What this report shows is there was a determined effort that proved to be, as the Republicans and Democrats said, a national security threat to sabotage the 26 campaign. This report doesn't say it was a bogus scandal. And so your question of whether it's on a collision course, we'll see. He is determined to investigate, what they say, investigate the investigators, to see whether there were more abuses. And there have been some abuses that have been turned up in terms of how the FBI handled this. But the question is whether, at the end of the day, the Durham investigation will have some kind of small bore details that really don't change the narrative from what this Senate report has laid out in pretty exhaustive detail.
Just two more questions before we have to say goodbye. The dossier is does come up in this report. It seems that the report or the senators are critical of the dossier, but they do use a lot of information that the dossier found as part of this report, to looking at he wasn't the president at the time, looking at Donald Trump and his relationship with women while in Russia.
So they are critical of the dossier. They're critical of how the FBI handled both the dossier and the person who put it together, Christopher Steele, a former British intelligence operative. The report doesn't stand up any element of the dossier. But as you say, it has some, I'd say, sort of dossier adjacent material in it, which gets at some issues that are raised in the dossier, which is Trump's trips to Moscow to scout out the Miss Universe contest going back some number of years, and his relationships with women in Moscow. And, you know, with the greater question is, was there any compromising material that the Russians might have had on the president that might have led that given them leverage over it? Now, they raise some episodes, but there's nothing conclusive, and they don't assert that there is compromising material. Frankly, I was a little surprised that so much of that information got into this report that is, in a way, very inconclusive.
Let me ask you, too, about one of the findings, and I'm going to quote here. Campaigns should notify the FBI of all foreign offers of assistance, should reject the use of foreign material, especially if obtained illegally. And this is one of the recommendations from the report. There was no legal obligation to do that before 2016 or at all?
Well, I mean, it one could say there was, or there is, that if you have an offer of, help from a foreign adversary to help a campaign, technically you're supposed to call the FBI and report it because there's a crime there. But it's not something that obviously has been enforced. And it's not something that, as we've been well noted, Trump campaign advisors took very seriously. And I should say that over the years, other campaigns who have, had approaches from foreign governments haven't taken it seriously either. So maybe one thing that comes out of it is at least an awareness and a knowledge that if you are getting help from a foreign entity, something should trigger in your head that that this is not right, and perhaps you should notify the FBI about it.
I just have to say something to my studio. I'm home. You're probably home. I just want to make sure our second guest is ready. So if someone can just tell me that she's ready to go, she's good. All right. One just quick final question to you, Mark. I mean, is this report going to gather dust somewhere, get filed away? Is it going to be turned into policy? What's its future?
I think the hope
of putting it out now among some members of the Senate Intelligence Committee was to, in the very short term, raise awareness of what's happening now. The intelligence community has said the Russians and other foreign adversaries are trying to do the same thing in this election before November, as they did in 2016. But I don't think that that's really resonating too much with ordinary Americans. I think that you know, all these reports do gather dust to a degree, but I do think that it will be useful for the future for those to trying to understand what happened in 2016. What were the contacts? What was the strategy by the Kremlin to do this? Now, a lot of the report is still buried in black ink. There's a lot of redactions. It's our job to find out what's behind those redactions, so we find out more about what happened. And you know, for history, to be able to, you know, make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
Well, Mark Mazzetti, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times. Well, from the 2016 election to the threat of Russian meddling in the 2020 election and their use of disinformation, we're also going to be discussing the poisoning of Putin critic Alexei Navalny, who's in a German hospital, and the protests in Belarus against Europe's last dictator, President Alexander Lukashenko. Protesters have taken to the streets since the election in early August when Lukashenko declared victory. They have called for him to resign, saying the results were rigged. There have been thousands of arrests, including two opposition leaders on Monday. Joining us is Nina Jankowicz, and she's disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, author of a new book called How to Lose the Information War. And earlier in her career, she worked on democracy support projects in Russia and in Belarus. And Nina Jankowicz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Before talking about 2020, I just want to get your response to the Senate Intelligence Report in 2016, their conclusion that Russia did indeed interfere in our election, and they had some willing, if not accomplices, certainly partners coming from the Trump administration. What's your main takeaway from this Senate report?
Sure. So I think, you know, what's striking to me is the connection between Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik, who, you know, there were always murmurings that Kilimnik had Russian intelligence ties. He was indeed fired from a job at the International Republican Institute in the 90s for those suspected ties to Russian intelligence. And when Manafort and Kilimnik were working in Ukraine, they were doing a lot to undermine Ukraine's democratic trajectory. And indeed, we saw all of that then playing out during the 2016 campaign, where we saw, you know, the Republican platform take away lethal weapons, take away support from Ukraine. And then, you know, this planting and amplifying of Russian disinformation about things like the CrowdStrike conspiracy and the DNC server of this peace plan for Ukraine, which Kilimnik was trying to push. And then even, you know, undermining of the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine. All of that was coming through that vector of Kilimnik. And that's what's so disturbing to me. It's not only, you know, that the Trump campaign was seemingly influenced by a Russian operative. That affects U.S. foreign policy, not only in Ukraine, but in the entire Eastern and Central European region. And indeed, the way our support for democracy around the world is viewed.
How does disinformation work, and perhaps how Russia uses disinformation? What makes it effective?
I think this is something that's really misunderstood, and it has really been playing out during the coronavirus pandemic, as we see a lot of disinformation about the virus proliferating. Disinformation isn't just cut and dry fake news. It's not just a funny picture that somebody photoshopped or a fake article. It runs on emotion. It runs on people's real lived experiences. And Russia, over a period of basically a few decades, if you go back to the Soviet period, but certainly the last 15 years in the online era, has become really good at identifying and exploiting those societal fissures so that it can turn societies against one another and really undermine the democratic process. And certainly, I think that's what we're seeing here in the United States today.
Is there, when you look at disinformation, broadly speaking, is there generally some kind of kernel of truth buried in that disinformation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's why Ukraine is a really great disinformation topic for Russia to spread its narratives about, particularly in the United States, and why we're seeing, you know, false narratives and conspiracy theories about Vice President Biden's involvement in Ukraine and things like that come up time and time again, because Americans kind of think about Ukraine as this far off place. They don't know very much about it. They hear over and over that it's corrupt. And it's a really complex and nuanced place. But to do all that research to understand Ukraine and its realities today, you know, it takes time. And most Americans don't have time. Same thing with the coronavirus pandemic. We see, you know, fear and mistrust of government authorities cropping up for a good reason based on the government's response to the pandemic. And actors like Russia, like China, are exploiting those fears and that distrust in order to sow conspiracy theories about vaccines and 5G, or in many cases, just amplifying conspiracy theories that have grown kind of organically in American society. Bad actors don't even really need to lift a finger in that case.
Well, which raises the question, then, how do you counter disinformation, whether it's about CrowdStrike or Ukraine or the pandemic?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think we in the United States tend to think about removing the bad information, whether that's, you know, removing it and doing content moderation on social media platforms or trying to debunk it in the press. And my research across Central and Eastern Europe shows that the countries that are more resilient towards disinformation, that have been more successful in countering it, don't do as much of the debunking and the removal. What they're concentrating on is removing those societal fissures. Hmm. So repairing their governance, repairing things like endemic racism that exists here in the United States, or economic disparity, or integration of ethnic populations. Those are the things that they focus on, in addition to building up society's media and digital literacy, building up an understanding of civics. All of these things are generational investments. They're not quick fixes. And I think that's why we've seen a hesitance from some people in, you know, our political elite to invest in them, because it's not going to give us returns in a couple years. But when you look at the campaigns that Russia has been running, again, these aren't short-term things. Even for the 2016 election, Russia began its interference in 2013, 2014 here in the United States. So we need to make those long-term investments as well. And I argue that if we look to our allies in Central and Eastern Europe who have had some success for this, we don't really need to reinvent the wheel. We can try to replicate the projects that they've implemented successfully on a greater scale here in the United States.
Well, I do want to pick up on that. First, a very short break. Talking with Nina Jankowicz. She's disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, author of a new book called How to Lose the Information War. We're talking about disinformation. We'll also be talking about the protests in Belarus and also the poisoning of a Putin critic after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Nina Jankowicz. She's a disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, author of a new book called How to Lose the Information War. We've been talking about how Russia uses disinformation. And as I mentioned right before the break, we do want to talk about what's happening in Belarus and also the poisoning of a critic of Putin, a guy named Alexei Navalny, who is in a German hospital. Nina, just picking up on what you were saying right before the break, which is that we could take some lessons from what Eastern Europe has been doing to counter some of this disinformation. But as you said, this is a kind of a generational response. You're not going to deal with systemic racism or economic disparity in a couple of years. Does it require a kind of patience? And what do you do in the meantime?
Yeah, it absolutely requires patience and kind of that long-term investment, the idea that not only do we need to introduce school-age children to these concepts, but we need to introduce adults to them as well.
Right.
And what you need with that, Marty, is a recognition from the very top that this is a problem. It's a problem not only for our national security, but it's also a problem for our democracy, regardless of your political party. And unfortunately, here in the United States, the issue of disinformation over the past 4 years has become increasingly politicized to the extent that even the most common sense regulation that's been introduced in Congress is just sitting there, not even getting votes or hearings because it has become so politicized. So if you look at Eastern Europe, the governments that recognize the problem and recognize that disinformation is a threat, whether it's foreign or domestic, are the ones that are doing a good job. So I'm hoping that we'll see more leadership from Capitol Hill, more nonpartisan, bipartisan leadership in this issue. And until then, I worry that we're going to be on the back foot. You know, there's a reason my book is called How to Lose the Information War, not How to Win It.
And yes, I think,
unfortunately,
I noticed that.
You know, we're definitely losing it at this current juncture.
Well, in the meantime, then it's on us to be able to discriminate and to know whether the information that's being sent to us is real or not. Is it information or is it disinformation?
Yeah, and that's actually pretty easy for people to do. You know, especially during the pandemic, I've been trying to use the moniker of informational distancing for people who are trying to suss out whether something is disinformation or not. Because information, disinformation, as I mentioned before, runs on emotion. So if you're feeling yourself getting extremely emotional about a piece of content, the best thing you can do, don't hit the share button, remove your finger, walk away from your device for a little bit. And then if it's still bothering you, try to do some lateral reading, compare sources, see if anyone else is reporting this. And then one really important thing that everybody, I'm sure, who's listening to your great show can learn how to do is a reverse image search on Google or another service, because often we're seeing images that are misattributed. And that's a really great way to you know, decipher if something is a trustworthy source or not. You can basically just right-click on the image if you're using the Chrome browser or use other services, as I mentioned, and that'll show you the first instances of that image online. So you can tell if it's been changed or when it was first used. You know, here in Washington, we often see during hurricane season pictures of a shark in the Potomac. It's a faked image, and a reverse image search will show you that that's the case.
I mean, it sounds like you're telling the public, well, act like a journalist, act more like a journalist. Check
yeah,
your facts.
Yeah,
check
a little
sources.
Bit. You know, nobody needs to take on a full open source investigation, but
no.
Just slowing yourself down before you share that information and doing a little bit of due diligence is really important, because we are the front lines of the information war right now.
Let me just give out the information to join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can call us. That phone number, as always, 1-888-477-9499. Nina, you've done work in Belarus, and I want to get your response to the protests there. This is after President Lukashenko claimed victory. This was in early August. He says he won in a landslide. Protesters are saying the results were rigged. When you see so many people taking to the streets, whether Minsk or other parts of Belarus, what does that tell you? What does that tell us?
Well, this is a real change in Belarus. You know, for 26 years, Lukashenko really maintained quite a tight control over the country. And that was in part because of the social contract he had. You know, he came up through the ranks of Soviet politicians because he was strongly against corruption. And he kind of maintained this air of anti-corruption during his time as president of Belarus, keeping the endemic corruption that we see in other post-Soviet countries a bit under wraps, providing pretty decent health care and schooling for the people of Belarus. But that has all kind of fallen down around him, especially this year. He called the COVID-19 pandemic a psychosis and really
wow.
Didn't shore up a coherent response to that, to the detriment of Belarusians. And also, you know, the rigging of this election was just so blatant. There were videos of poll workers basically dropping ballots out of windows of polling places. There's evidence that ballots were destroyed. And independent observers who looked at the election were able to analyze over 500,000 ballots. And they said that this landslide victory, he claimed, is statistically impossible. And in fact, benefited his opponent to the tune of 80%, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who was forced to run because her husband and another opposition candidate were thrown in jail before the election, which is not something that Lukashenko has done before. So people are tired of that. They're tired of that blatant rigging, blatant disrespect for their democratic rights. And then, of course, in these protests in the ensuing 2 weeks, you know, people have been beaten really, really to the point of death. Two people have died at least. A couple of other suspicious deaths have been discovered, and thousands of people have been arrested. And Belarusians are just standing up and demanding something very, very basic that I think should resonate with many Americans, which is that they want their voices heard and their votes counted. That's it. They're not asking for anything about, you know, European Union integration. They've even said they'll work with Russia. They just want to be heard.
He is President Lukashenko has been called Europe's last dictator, and he shows no evidence of either wanting to meet with protesters or his critics or stepping down. How do you see this ending as you look into your crystal ball?
Well, I try not to predict the future, especially in this region, because it can be very unpredictable. But I think right now things are on a precipice. Protesters continue to go out in the streets despite Lukashenko's threats. And Lukashenko is really trying to extend an arm to Russia for help. He really is pushing narratives about the protesters being anti-Russian, even though they've said over and over that they are not. And he's trying to get Russian involvement going. Russia, for its part, has really stepped back. It has sent some support to state TV and things like that to prop up the propaganda outlets during this time. But in terms of military support, you know, we haven't seen Russia do what it did in Ukraine, and that is good. But unfortunately, that means that a lot is weighing on Russia's next steps. And so, you know, we've seen U.S. diplomats in the region this week. Steve Begun and George Kent were in Lithuania meeting with Tikhanovskaya. She had to flee. That opposition candidate had to flee from Belarus. They then went to Moscow, and they'll be ending the week in Vienna at a meeting with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which deals with elections and democratic issues. Russia is a member, so we'll see if any agreements about a negotiated transition or at least agreements to discuss a transition or new elections with the opposition come out of those meetings.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. And let's also talk about Alexei Navalny. Doctors in Germany said earlier this week that he probably had been poisoned. The Kremlin says these allegations are not true. They can't be taken seriously. Not that you have special, unique information, Nina, but I'm just curious. When you look at Alexei Navalny and his work as a critic of Putin, he's been jailed several times. He's had other sort of toxic substances that he's had to deal with. What do you make of what happened to him?
Well, I don't think we can take the Kremlin at its word here. You know, there is a history, a long and unfortunately sordid history of poisonings and political killings in Russia. Anna Politkovskaya, a journalist who uncovered some really awful human rights abuses in Chechnya, was poisoned and then later shot in cold blood in her apartment stairway. Vladimir Karamurza, who has had to flee Russia, was poisoned twice and survived. We, of course, know about Litvinenko, the poisoning in the UK that was in the early 2000s. There's just too many examples for this to be merely a coincidence. And, you know, there's also the fact that the Russian doctors who were treating Navalny before he was evacuated to Germany initially said he was poisoned and then changed their story. Meanwhile, they stonewalled his evacuation from the country. I mean, one has to assume that they did this to dilute the evidence that was available in Navalny's body so it wouldn't be quite so damning. So, you know, Navalny has been a real impediment to Putin's rule. He has really drawn a lot of popular support from ordinary Russians who don't want to see a corrupt government. In addition to being an opposition politician, he's a talented anti-corruption investigator and has these video investigations he posts on YouTube that get millions of views because they are accessible to normal people and expose the way that the elites in Russia are taking advantage of the system to the detriment of ordinary Russians. So there is clearly, you know, a reason for them to have them in their sights. The question is whether, you know, this order came from the Kremlin and Putin itself or whether this is a rogue security official or local official who decided to take matters into their own hands. And either way, it's a kind of scary, scary situation, certainly a chilling effect on other journalists, politicians, anti-corruption investigators in Russia.
Sure.
It's a warning
signal.
I mean,
it sends a very strong message, correct?
Yeah.
Just picking up on those YouTube videos that he, Alexei Navalny, has posted, apparently these are drone footage of Russian leaders' homes, their lavish lifestyles, someone with a bunch of, like, rubber duckies.
Yes. Yeah, they're really interesting videos. I mean, it shows one in particular showed, you know, the lavish lifestyle of former Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Right. He hasn't touched Putin himself, but all of the people around him. He coined the phrase the party of crooks and thieves to describe United Russia, the ruling party. And, you know, Navalny definitely scares the Kremlin. He had a mayoral run in 2013 in which, you know, he ran for mayor of Moscow and almost caused a runoff. In fact, if there hadn't been widespread, you know, ballot rigging, there probably would have been a runoff between Navalny and the incumbent. He tried to run for president in 2018, but was barred from the ballot. And I actually acted as an election observer during that election. I was posted to a small town in the Samara Oblast. So this is southern Russia, an industrial town, and a village outside of it where we visited one polling station, a snowbound, beautiful little village. I went into one of the booths, as election observers do, to kind of check out to make sure everything is in order there. And even though Navalny wasn't on the ballot, someone who had come in to cast their vote, either, you know, not voting for anyone or spoiling their ballot, had written Navalny's name around the polling booth, because that's the support that he has, even if in those tiny, tiny villages and towns. Now, you know, the Kremlin is going to continue to do what it can to keep people like Navalny and Navalny's associates down, to bar them from access to the ballot and, you know, to send these signals to the rest of the opposition figures that this behavior is not to be tolerated. I wish that we were seeing a stronger response from the United States right now. I'm a little bit concerned that we have only seen one statement from Secretary of State Pompeo, and it was couched in a lot of shoulds and ifs after the German doctors released their assessment. You know, he said, if this is true, we will demand a full investigation. And I think at this point it is clear, and any other administration would be clearly speaking out against this and demanding that those who are responsible be brought to justice.
Let me see if I can squeeze a caller in before we have to say goodbye. This is Adrian from Elkins Park. And Adrian, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Oops. Okay. I'm going to just read what Adrian has to say. Adrian says, at the same time there are mass protests in Belarus, there was a huge amount of people to celebrate an organized march celebrating veterans who fought against Russia in Ukraine. Nina, can you respond to that?
There have been a couple of pro-government protests that have also been organized. We've seen people bust in from all around the country in support of Lukashenko. But from the images that I have seen, we've seen, you know, much more support on the opposition side.
Let me just ask you something just briefly about Navalny, who is, I believe, in a medically induced coma. I mean, there's some question, I guess, about his recovery. Are you concerned about whether he will recover, and if he can, just how healthy he's going to be?
Absolutely. I mean, he was poisoned, according to the German doctors, with a nerve agent, which could have very serious consequences for his mobility and his, you know, mental capacity. I'm also concerned about whether, you know, if he does recover, he will decide to go back to Russia, because this is a very serious threat on his life, although he hasn't really been stymied by any of this before. So I would be surprised if he didn't. But again, the chilling effect that this has, not even on, you know, activists, but ordinary Russians who want to speak out and make their voices heard, can't be understated.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to you, Nina Jankowicz. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. You're a Bryn Mawr graduate, right?
I am. I love WHYY, so it's a pleasure to be on.
Shameless plug there, right? That's Nina Jankowicz, and again, disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, author of a new book titled How to Lose the Information War. And earlier in her career, she worked on democracy support projects in Belarus that we were just talking about, also in Russia that we were also just talking about. And we began our conversation with Mark Mazzetti, Washington investigative correspondent for The New York Times, spending the hour talking about Russia and the United States. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.